May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Ben Sternke. I'm here with Matt Tebbe and Christy Penley.
Hey, hey.
What's up, Dream Team?
Oh.
What's up, fam?
What up?
I don't know. Using what up, Ben? Slangs dream. And things like that.
Oh, Dream Team.
Dream Team, fam.
Woohoo. Listen to you.
We're just commenting on Christy's pink headphones. None of you guys can see Christy's pink headphones, but I see them. Every time we record one of these intros, every time we record a podcast, we see each other.
Yeah. Our guests often comment on them.
They are striking, Christy.
They're very bright.
They're very bright
they're
and striking.
So fun.
They are fun.
It's just fun. It's like the 13-year-old girl in me just loves doing this. So
They bring a little bit of brightness and effervescence into my day, and I'm appreciative of them. Speaking of brightness and effervescence... I don't know if that was a good transition or not, but
sure.
we got somebody emailed the podcast a few days ago and sent us a recipe.
A recipe? Yeah.
A recipe, Christy.
It's true.
The recipe for?
So initially I was a little confused. I was like, why is he emailing a recipe? But then I remembered that in our outro... on all these podcast episodes, we threw in a little line that I thought would be funny, that you can send us, you know, a suggestion for an interview, like email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Send us, you know, these things that are all normal. And then a recipe, send us a recipe, whatever. And so for Oktoberfest, we got a recipe for pretzels.
Pretzels, like the hot, you know, pretzels that you put cheese on and stuff?
Yeah, you can have them with your Oktoberfest beer.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah,
salt cool? them. Have you? Did you try it?
No, we haven't tried it yet. I think I'd like to, but we're going to post it. We'd like to post it on the podcast page.
Yep.
And so there'll be like a collection of recipes. If anybody else wants to email us a recipe, just email us like your favorite recipe.
Your
and
then pumpkin, we'll have like a little recipe.
The Gravity Leadership Podcast Cookbook.
I love it.
Yeah,
I love it. I'm gonna try it too. Although I'm gluten free, so I'm gonna have to
you probably skip the pretzels.
No. They got gluten-free.
Oh, you're going to try them.
Like, yeah, gluten-free, you know.
Okay. Well, not this recipe.
Flour.
Yeah.
I'll just change it out.
Okay. Yeah, I do a lot
of almond flour or something?
One of my daughters and my wife is...
Rice flour,
there's like a one-to-one gluten-free flour that we use a lot.
Yeah.
It's like a red combo of all those things. Yeah, it's red mill.
Everybody
yeah,
knows about great. This except anyway. For me. Where have I been?
Oh,
well,
I'm
actually,
sorry.
I think ours
are
is
you
a different
gluten-free?
Brand.
But...
No, I'm not. That's probably why I don't know anything about it.
That's why you don't know about it.
So why don't I know about this? Oh, yeah. I
that's
don't
why.
Need to.
Be
that's
thankful
why.
You don't know about it, actually.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Anyway, we'll post... We're grateful to... who was it that sent us that? Do you remember, Matt?
I can get his name if you stall for time.
I was trying to remember.
Can you stall
for
time?
Let me stall for time. Yes, yes. Just send me a signal. Steal third? No, stall for time. Okay.
Stalling for time.
All right. Stalling while I'm going to stall
while
by...
While you're stalling, all of our listeners should sign up to get, if they haven't already... The email that you send out on Fridays.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I was going to do, Christy. I was going to go right into the blurbs.
It's like we're thinking the same thing.
That's good. Christy, why should they do that? What's the benefit of signing up?
You know what? It's really good. There's links in there. And they're to all different things, articles. And
they're a lot of fun.
Yeah, they are. And it's worth the read. Some emails, if I'm honest, aren't worth the read. This one is. And so if you're listening and you haven't signed up for that, I encourage you to sign up and get those every Friday.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah. And there, a lot of them are, they relate to ministry and sort of what it's like to lead nowadays. And so they're helpful for those who are leading faith communities and leading as Christians in our day and age. But some of them are just sort of like, I don't know, they're just sort of interesting stuff that's stuff that we find interesting. So it's a lot of kind of cultural commentary and leadership stuff. But there's also, you know, who knows? We might put recipes in there if we find a good one.
Pretzel recipes by our friend.
Did we look it up, Matt?
Paul Walker.
Sorry, Paul Walker.
Yes, Paul Walker at the Meeting House in Canada.
Yep.
So.
That's awesome.
Thanks for sending us that recipe. And friends, you can send us a recipe too. podcast at gravityleadership.com. You know, sometimes you get your syllables mixed up. I almost said gravity laddership.
That's something different.
That's a different thing. All right.
Totally different thing. Yes, email us. And then to sign up for the links, go to gravityleadership.com/join. That's free. Also, if you are in the Northwest Indiana area and you're free on the weekend of November 19th and 20th, come join us.
Tell them.
Or
tell
if you're
them
not
Chesterton,
in the area
and you,
wanna
fly
you want
in,
to go, come
fly
in
into
still.
Chicago or Indy. Yep. Yeah. Come in still. We're doing a discipleship workshop. It's called Follow the Way. We're going to talk about the missing ingredient in most of our discipleship processes and what to do about it, what we need to reckon with if we're going to follow Jesus. So we're really looking forward to that.
Yes. Yeah. I know.
But we have a podcast we got to get into.
Yeah, we do. I think that's all we need to blurb.
We should do that.
For right now. The podcast we're getting into is with Daniel Bowman Jr. And Matt, do you want to introduce, what's this podcast all about? What's this guy's book all about?
Yeah, Daniel Bowman. Yeah, he wrote a book about being autistic. And he's a poet. He teaches. Yeah. Here in Indiana at a Christian college, and he wrote a book about being neurodivergent. And some of you know, I think I've mentioned a few times here that I've recently been diagnosed with ADHD, which is part of a constellation of neurodivergencies. And I felt a little sheepish, like claiming that title, that label, because it feels like, well, I'm not that divergent, or I either downplay it because I don't want to relativize other people's suffering, or it feels like a little shameful for me. I think I struggle with both of those things, right? Mm. And
yeah,
does that make sense? Like, I don't want to claim a minority status if it doesn't really apply to me. But I also then feel a little embarrassed because I'm like, well, you know, neurodivergent sounds bad. You know, there's like a stigma attached to it.
Yeah, that's not normal. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but then he wrote this book on the spectrum, Autism, Faith, and the Gifts of Neurodiversity, which you can see there in the show notes. And he opened up about being autistic and a Christian and some of the things that he's learned. And it was a wide-ranging conversation, chatted a lot about his life as a Christian and the things that he's had to overcome or accept in order to like live faithfully as a neurodivergent person. And then we talked a little bit about how his book is really different because I think it's part memoir, part theology, like understanding neurodivergency, and then part prose and poetry. Like he's a really good artist. So anyway, all that to say, and he was a lot of fun to talk to. So I took this interview personally.
It was good. It was really good. I'm thinking though, for like listeners that have children that are autistic or have some sort of this could be really encouraging because it was really fun to see just his giftings and the way that he shines, and he's really smart. And so anyway, maybe for a parent who's like struggling because their kid just got an IEP in third grade and they're like, oh my goodness, what does this mean for my kid? This could be encouraging.
Yeah, good. All right, well, let's get into it.
Daniel Bowman Jr., welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Dan is an author, a poet, an associate professor of English at Taylor University in Upland, Indiana, where he co-directs the Making Literature Conference. He's the editor-in-chief of Relief, a journal of art and faith, and engages in several in-person and online communities addressing neurodiversity and mental health, and mentors young people on the autistic spectrum. Dan, anything else we need to know about you?
That covers the big stuff. I've been at Taylor, so we're getting geared up for the new school year, and this will be my 11th year. So I've put in a full decade at Taylor, and we're kind of taking off on that last point about mentoring young people. We have a group that I write about toward the end of the book called SEND, which is a student-formed and student-led group. SEND stands for Students for Education on Neurodiversity. And I'm the faculty advisor to that group. And so we've got students who are autistic, ADHD, and otherwise neurodivergent, or folks who are just interested in wellness and mental health in general and want to support their peers and learn more about overall mental health as college students, which is, it's a stressful time. As much fun as it can be, it can be a stressful time too. So we're there to support people.
Yeah. Great, Dan. Well, you're talking about the topic that your book that just came out is on. The title of the book is On the Spectrum, Autism, Faith, and the Gifts of Neurodiversity. Dan, I in the last 4 years, I was diagnosed with ADHD. It was like the worst kept secret in my family that I had ADHD, and I sort of self-medicated with street Ritalin, which is not illegally bought Ritalin. I mean coffee, like just copious amounts of caffeine to try to manage that. But only in the last 4 years have I begun to take my ADHD seriously. To even know what the word neurodivergent means, and then to reckon with the cost of being, of spending 40 plus years of my life ignoring that. And so I was really excited to read your book because, maybe before we get into the meat of it, could you just tell the story? I know you also kind of reckoned with neurodivergency later in life. Could you tell the story just about how you came to realize and identify as autistic?
Yeah, it kind of makes up what I call the prelude of the book, this long personal essay at the outset of the book. And as so often happens, I think crisis can lead us to greater understanding. And so I was going through a personal crisis, a relational crisis in my family, and trying to make sense of why I was the way I was and how I approached the world and what made me tick. And I had always got, you know, and the ironic thing for me is I'd always gone to spiritual direction, counseling, all these things. And I've read about and used all these tools of discernment, like the Enneagram that has become so popular now, and some of these other things. So I thought I was well on my way towards self-awareness, but I was missing this enormous piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
And when I started to do the research, and again, I was, circumstances kind of forced me to have to reckon and deal with what comes next, and in fact, heal from some trauma. And so I kind of went down that rabbit hole of research. And when I encountered autism, or was also called Asperger's at the time, everything fit. I mean, I just went down this checklist and I thought, I had no idea there were other people who fit this criteria. It's so oddly specific to me. I can't believe it's so insightful, this whole list. And I just went down the list and it fit. So then I had to, you know, come to terms with that, decide to, if I was going to be open about it, start talking about it, start writing about it. And I'm a writer, and the best way I know how to make sense out of something is to explore it through language.
Yeah. 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 So maybe for our listeners, so I mean, I was an 80s kid, Dan, I'm not sure when you grew up. And my entire experience and frames for autism, like most 80s kids, was framed by Rain Man.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's it. That's the only thing we had culturally available to us
right.
to have any kind of reference. So maybe give us an idea about what were some of the things that you began, some of your characteristics that you began to identify as autism. And then maybe I want to back up from there, but what were some of the characteristics that cinched it for you?
Yeah. So, I grew up on the Rain Man, paradigm also, I suppose. You're right, there wasn't much more out there. There's a lot more now, although it's still, you know, really developing. You know, do they have autistic actors play these roles, and autistic people, are they writing these shows and movies and things like that? But as far as, I mean, I never could have seen myself reflected in Rain Man, so the word autism never would have come up on my radar. I was not a savant. I'm horrible at math and numbers. And all that kind of stuff. It's more about communication and sort of social differences, different ways of being in the world when it comes to communicating. A lot of trouble with sensory processing. That was always huge for me. And, you know, that starts in childhood and... that can be tough for a lot of kids. They might just think you're a fussy eater or something. And having grown up in the 80s also, you ate what was on your plate. And so if you had a sensory processing issue with either a texture or a flavor or an aroma or something like that, could really, a food could really repulse you, you know? And I didn't know why am I so sensitive to all these different things? And so, yeah, the list goes on. Trouble making friends, socializing the way that other people did, sort of being cool. I always felt very awkward. I overthought everything. And then I also would get obsessed with what we call special interests. You know, I would just pick up on something and go so deep into it that nothing could tear me away. So yeah, that's a lot of the sort of the main traits and characteristics.
Yeah, Christy, Ben, did you, maybe growing up or even as you raise your kids, how has autism, has it been on your radar? Are you, do you intersect at all with what Dan's talking about?
I didn't until recently. I mean, I just sort of knew about ADHD, sort of tangentially, you know, I just knew it was a thing. And had kind of a cursory understanding of what it meant and all that kind of thing. But my teenage daughter actually was, during the pandemic, I think the disruption to her schedule, she's like 17 years old, and the disruption to her schedule caused us to realize that something different was going on than just normal and, you know, going through a pandemic as a high schooler is hard type stuff. And she was actually diagnosed with ADHD this year, or maybe early last year. I can't remember, but it was a completely new world. It still feels like a completely new world to try to understand what's going on for her and for her as well. Like she's had to learn how to, cause she, I think, you know, our best guess is that she just masked it really well, up until that point,
yeah.
You know, just sort of learned to kind of get along. But it's been really helpful for her to have this diagnosis because it's helped us to understand what's going on with her. But it's also helping her to understand what's going on with herself.
Yeah.
Like she used to just think, oh, I'm just dumb, or I'm just lazy, or I'm just, you know, she would have these stories that she'd tell herself about some of these things. And it was like, eventually it was really helpful for us to learn. Like she actually has a neurodivergency or a neurodiversity. There's something happening different in her brain than the rest of the brains in our family. And that's, you know, it's been challenging to navigate because, you know, it just is those differences, but it's been really helpful, but it wasn't on my radar like it is now.
Yeah. I appreciate that point a lot about that. It redefines the way that you think about yourself. And, you know, researchers have always said, when I work with adults with autism and I ask them to talk about their childhood and talk about the way they were, they say things like, I just felt like an alien. I thought I was just dumb. Yeah. I thought, because if you don't have a name, you default to, I must just be worse than everybody. I'm just no good at this life thing. And so when you have a name for it, you realize
you never think,
it's just
I must
a different
be better
brain.
Than everyone.
Yeah. So you find out that your brain works differently and it's not your fault. And that's so empowering.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. That's a really concise way of saying it.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that you're on this podcast, Dan, because I have a son who I've actually asked the doctor, please test him for being autistic. Mm-hmm. I have five kids, and there's just something different about one of mine that I can't put a finger on.
Mm.
And we had him tested, and then we had him tested like 2 years later, and right now nothing has come through. And yet I'm just curious, like, it seems as though there's a spectrum, right? And so maybe he's not testing where the test meets on the spectrum, but as his mama, I still think he's on the spectrum. Mm. I don't know if you can speak to that at all.
Yeah. Probably trust your gut. That makes a lot of sense to me. When I started going down that path, toward self-diagnosis first, because I began to understand, okay, this lines up really well with me, but there are different, manifestations, because it is a spectrum, and the spectrum is not, it's not like, okay, down here is low functioning, very autistic people, and up here is sort of just mildly autistic, very high functioning people. It's not really like that. Instead, there are all these areas, language acquisition. I have college students who are autistic, and they're very, very smart. And some of them didn't speak until they were four, and they had all kinds of tests done. Everybody was worried. Everyone was so nervous and upset and everything. I spoke early, you know, I didn't have that trouble. So there's all kinds of different areas that you have to touch on with language and communication, social issues. Ben mentioned, pointed out a lack of structure or a taking away of routine, will throw people for a loop, who are on the spectrum or who are neurodivergent in any way. So all these areas will hit some people really, really hard. Others, will it be hit hard in certain areas, but not other areas?
Sure.
It's tough to diagnose. Even within one area like sensory processing, somebody might have a lot of trouble with noises. It's pretty common, you know, so you may see noise canceling headphones on a young autistic child, because the noises are upsetting and we hear them at louder frequencies and pitches and stuff. Others may not have that. But they'll have visual issues, you know, I have a bit of that stuff. I can't focus if there's a little pile of clutter across the room that no one else even notices half the time. So we're all different. And the saying is that if you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. Because, you know, while we hover around these areas of neurodivergence, it's different for everybody. So.
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
Dan, you spend the first part of your book talking about how we have unfortunately pathologized some of the traits that make up the autistic spectrum. And there's words that are commonly, you make a list of words like awkward, odd, weird, yep. Lacking, inappropriate, poor, abnormal, like all these words. And I wonder then, could you describe, your title talks about the gifts of neurodivergency. And this is a shift I think culturally we're making. But what is it, how do we reframe this being on the spectrum as a gift rather than a deficiency? And maybe if you have personal ways that, like personal artifacts from your life, for instance, the clutter, you know, or other things where you've gone from seeing pathologizing language to gift language.
Yeah. Well, let me think about how to approach that. First off, the title was somewhat put together more by the publisher than by me. So a lot of people are asking me about the gifts of neurodiversity. Sometimes I just say, I don't know. I didn't make up that phrase, but you're right there. It's actually come as a really good challenge to me because then I do have to think about that. And I do work very hard to reframe that conversation at the outset of the book to say, look, do you know how that feels when you're reading an article about who you are? And it says inappropriate contact, odd behavior, strange, unusual posture, and all these things. And I'm like, am I that freakish? Like, I don't feel like I am. I feel like I'm just trying to be in the world like everybody else. And so to change that from a pathology or deficit model to say, well, look, we communicate differently. If we were face-to-face right now, I would not be sustaining eye contact. I would initially make it, and then I would look away, and I'd probably be stimming in some way, you know, or something like that.
Stimming is soothing anxiety,
just like a self-regulatory behavior. Sometimes children will, like, they're excited, flap their hands, or sometimes people play with a little object.
Fidget spinners,
all that sort
like
of
that.
Stuff. And people do different kinds of things. Some are very pronounced, and that's when they tend to freak out parents, you know, who don't understand that behavior actually has a good purpose, that it's regulatory for their emotions. So they'll send them into therapy basically just to try to eliminate the behavior. But to go back to the gifts of neurodiversity, I think, I wrote this book and it's a bit of a collage. It's not a straight linear narrative. It's all these different pieces put together. Some are epistolary pieces where I'm writing in the form of a letter to somebody. There are found pieces. There are bits of research dropped in and analyzed. There's poetry. There are traditional essays. I think a gift of neurodiversity is maybe assembling my work differently in a way that fits with my style of thinking, and in the process, maybe making a work of art that's unique or that's good. There's a book called Writers on the Spectrum that I read, and I talk about this a lot in the book. This is a meaningful book to me by Julie Brown. And she talks about the short story writer, the American writer, Sherwood Anderson, And he's credited with inventing the cycle of short stories, where it's not a novel and it's not just a book of different short stories. It's a cycle of short stories where some of the same characters appear in different stories. And he's thought to have been autistic. And they said, well, that's the way his brain worked. He didn't want to make a novel because it didn't work for him. Didn't want to make a bunch of discrete different short stories. That didn't quite work for him. So he made up this new style to fit what he was trying to accomplish artistically. So that's an example, I think, of a gift of neurodivergence.
Yeah. Yeah, this is so encouraging to me, Dan. When I was reading your book, I'm noticing how a lot of the constellation of my ADHD symptoms or characteristics, how I didn't have a framework for them neurobiologically. And so the story that non-neurodivergent people tell about these characteristics is that it is some kind of moral story.
Right.
Right? So then I internalized a junk ton of shame about being ADHD. My impulse control was off the charts bad. And I would do something and immediately I would think, why did I do that? And I have no idea why I did it, but I would be in tons of trouble and everybody would tell me how awful it was. And you know what I'm saying? And so there was actually no other reason outside of you're just a bad kid. And I hear you saying about that, maybe not so much behavior wise for you, but more of like, you're odd. You don't fit the norm. Yeah. Can you talk about, I mean, you talk a little bit about autistic kids are like a bullseye for bullies.
Yeah.
But how did that impact your growing up and your own self-conception as a Christian?
Yeah. That's the thing about the power of figuring stuff out later on. Is that you get to go back and reframe your past through a new lens of what you understand now about yourself. And so, I was definitely picked on and vulnerable because I lacked the social cognition that other people are born with. So I was trying to figure out social situations intellectually. I was trying to just put all the pieces together and try to work through it. Whereas other people, it came naturally to them, that skill set. So, it puts you in a vulnerable position, especially, when you're a kid and kids are mean, it can be tough. And when you're growing up in the church, as well, there's this other layer to it where, you know, if you have an extroverted pastor who likes knocking on doors and handing out tracts, and that scares the daylights out of you because you're autistic and you're not socially equipped to do something like that very well. You might think it's just because you don't have enough faith, you know? And so it becomes a moralized vision for what you are, when in fact, it's basically neurological.
You know, at Gravity, we talk a lot about being compassionately curious as we notice things in ourselves. And what I hear you maybe alluding to is we need to be compassionately curious about people who are different than us in that way, and not judge and not say this is a moral issue. Just, ask questions and be compassionate. And I guess I'm speaking out of conviction right now to my own son, right? Because he does things and I'm just honestly not very compassionate towards him. I just want him to get in line and do the thing and put his shoes on, get in a car. And if I saw him through a different lens, I think I would love him more holistically.
And it's so hard when you're close to the person. And so I think, it just makes it tricky. And family dynamics are all very tricky too. I have my older brother, who I'm fairly sure is neurotypical, is much more like my parents. And so he was a known quantity. You know, they understood what he was going to do and how he was going to act. And they felt safe and comfortable with that. And then I wasn't. I was just different. And so different equals bad a lot of the time. And that's, it's very, very tough. But yeah, I appreciate that. I think that insight about being compassionately curious or curiously compassionate to give each other the benefit of the doubt, I guess, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think just books like yours, Dan, that name, name difference without attaching pejorative or pathological labels to it, increases our empathy, increases our capacity to connect with and notice difference without eliminating it or judging it or condemning it. This is actually a controversial part of our culture right now. I think there's this, have you noticed this war on empathy? There's a war against like social emotional.
Yeah. I just saw something on this the other day. It's nothing more than like a meme or something, but, you know, it was something about, you know, how Satan works through the sin of compassion or something like that. And I thought, look, I know a lot of people who have had a tough go of it in life by virtue of others treating them without compassion. I don't know anyone who's gotten really screwed up because they got too much compassion. It's just not there for me. So I could be wrong, but yeah, I think we need a world more of it, not less.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess speaking as somebody who's responsible for things. So as a pastor, so Ben and I co-pastor, Christy's a pastor, and Ben and I co-lead Gravity. Christy helps lead cohorts for Gravity. Anytime you're trying to establish, you're trying to establish a culture, and then there's sort of free radicals in the culture, right? So it's a time of quiet at the beginning of our service, and somebody's making noises, or now we're praying still, and somebody's stimming, right? There's a sense in which, for somebody without empathy and compassion, it's a, like being neurodivergent could be evidence that you're a bad leader. You could tell yourself stories, you know, I'm a bad leader. Mm. That's why this person isn't following the social norms, or they're going to ruin this, or they're doing it wrong, or this is evidence of spiritual immaturity. All this stuff gets projected onto someone based upon the norm of, like you said, typical neurology. And I think that just having another frame to permit difference without having to judge, control, fix, is like, if I could give a gift to the American church, it would be that.
Yeah. And you know, some people have, kind of, you know, gone beyond just the talk about autism and neurobiology and neurodivergence, and said, in the grander sense, in the larger sense, we're just learning more about other people and how people's brains work. And when we do that, we tend to demand conformity a little bit less, and that frees people up to be themselves in ways that are whole and healthy, generally speaking.
Dan, in addition to talking about coming to grips with your autism and learning how to navigate that as a Christian and as an artist, you do talk about art, and you talk about, I think, something really interesting. You have this section of your book where you talk about what makes something good and what makes something bad when it comes to art, and what's the difference between good Christian art and bad Christian art. And I'm wondering if you could help us tease that out, because this is near and dear to my heart. There's a lot of bad Christian art out there.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I appreciate you bringing up that part of the book, because, you know, this is a somewhat of a collage or hodgepodge of a book. It's a memoir in essays, and I don't just stick to the topic of autism. And so if there are people who are looking at it just for the autistic stuff, you know, they may skip over these other parts, but the intersection of art and Christian faith is super important to me. And I've done a lot of thinking about it, and I teach about it. And I think probably a phrase that I've used for a long time that still applies to my way of thinking is that good art should comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And I think sometimes bad Christian art, so to speak, like let's say a Christian romance novel, just to pick on a genre that I literally know nothing about, but I assume it's bad. Let's say there's a cheesy Christian romance novel. I think that does the first objective, you know, it accomplishes the first thing. If you feel afflicted in life, and we all will, if you're suffering, it may bring comfort to you, you know, because there's this kind of certainty about it. It's formulaic, you know, it's predictable, you know what's going to happen, and it's couched in terms that aren't going to challenge you in any way. But it doesn't do that second part, you know. It doesn't shake you out of your comfort. And I think in the U.S., many of us are too comfortable too much of the time. Mm. So I think of, let's say, a film like Hotel Rwanda, if you've ever seen it. That is not something that you put on casually on Friday night to relax after a long week. That's a work of art where you have to go in intentionally saying, I'm willing to sit with people in their pain, brothers and sisters around the world who are suffering in unimaginable ways. So it's a work of art that, yes, it can bring you some comfort in your affliction, like watching a film can calm you or reading a book can calm you, but can also push you and challenge you and remind you that people all around the world are suffering every day. And the least we can do is pay attention.
Mm. That's good.
My wife and I had Hotel Rwanda on our list of movies to watch for over a year.
Mm.
And, you know, Friday night came and it was always like,
yeah,
should we watch Hotel Rwanda? you know,
that's just it. And so I try not to be too tough on people about that because I'm the same way. I don't want, after a long week, I want to watch whatever is the silliest, you know, most comforting thing I can find, and just with the laugh track on, you know, I grew up in the 80s. Yeah. It's the canned laughter. That's makes me feel, comfortable. But you know, other times we need to be willing to be afflicted in our state of overcomfort. And I think that's what good art can do. It can push us.
Yeah. You brought up Hotel Rwanda. So I'm going to go out on a limb here. I hope it doesn't break off and I fall to my death. But it sounds like you would hold then a position that you don't have to be a Christian to create good Christian art.
Yeah, I think so. That reminds me of a line by Richard Foster, I believe, who wrote The Celebration of Discipline. Mm-hmm. He said in an essay at one point on this very topic, someone was asking him, you know, what makes good Christian art or something along those lines. And he said, I'll probably get it wrong because I don't have the quote in front of me, but he says something like, any work that drills down into the subterranean chambers of the human soul can be art that Christians can grow from, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's absolutely right. There are writers who profess Christian faith, like a Marilynne Robinson or many Roman Catholic writers and others. And then there are plenty who don't, and I still learn a lot from them.
Yeah. Who are some of your favorite artists, Dan, just for those maybe who want to explore the writings or, you know, visual art or even cinema from people that you feel like are able to take us down into those chambers?
Yeah, again, thanks for asking. I don't get to talk about art or literature or the fine arts or anything all that much right now. I'm talking, trying to hash out a lot of autism stuff when I do these. For me, I always say this to begin with. What sort of drew me in to the power of art was when I was in college and I took a class on the 19th century British novel. So starting with Jane Austen, and then working our way up through the Victorians, like George Eliot, Thomas Hardy, and the Brontes. Those books sort of coincide with what we sometimes have called the modern psychological story. So you're getting inside the secret innermost hearts and minds of these characters with great psychological depth, you know, pre-Freud and pre-Carl Jung and stuff like that. So they just had these great insights about what it means to be human and what makes people tick and everything. And so those, I still look at those examples and I still watch a lot of those adaptations of those great Victorian masterpieces. Nowadays, I like people like Elizabeth Strout is one of my favorite novelists. I read a lot of fiction. The other day I was on, I did an event with the British writer Catherine May. She wrote a book that became a New York Times bestseller this past year called Wintering. She's an autistic writer who I'd love to just put her name out there. She doesn't profess Christian faith insofar as I know, but profoundly smart when it comes to insights about what it means to be human. And so she's written a couple excellent, excellent books.
It's good. Ben, you've read a book. You read a book recently.
I was like, did I write a book?
You were telling me about, what was that book that you read that you thought gave you the Jesus tinglies deep down in your heart?
Oh, I remember you talking about this, actually.
Oh my gosh, guys.
Was it
my mind is blanking.
One of the
what
best
was it?
Books that you
was it the Octavia
recently?
Butler book?
It made you think.
Well, Octavia, that did not give me tinglies. That gave me clinical depression. No, I'm joking about that. It was hard to read. Her stuff is pretty bleak. Yeah, I don't remember, guys. Was it on a podcast? Maybe it'll come to me.
I don't know. I don't know if it was or not.
Was it a novel?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I thought so.
But I do think, just in what you're talking about, Dan, I would say there is a huge need for good Christian art. I'm so tired. Yeah. I'm not trying to be judgmental, but I'm so tired of mediocrity.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think we as Christians, we can like go to those places that are deeper but why we don't, I mean, it's a crime because I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah. I think
so. If we have a listener out there who wants to be a good Christian artist, I'm saying go for it.
Yeah. People it's maybe fear of asking the hard questions and, you know, it's easier just to fit in to the community, to the church. And as soon as somebody starts asking the hard questions, they'll gain some fans and then they'll also gain some critics. And so it's tough to do.
Yeah. Well, it's vulnerable.
Yeah. 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 But I agree. I think, and it's partly because the church has been, historically so, skeptical of art. I mean, preachers in the 19th century thought that novels were evil and you shouldn't read them.
Right.
Or when I was a kid in the 1980s, you know, rock music or, you know, glam rock or whatever,
that
was, or anything that wasn't, you know,
the Gators.
Rich Mullins and Michael W. Smith or whatever was not was not good. It wasn't Christian. But it was good. There's a lot of good art being made.
Yeah, a lot of it was good.
Yeah.
Was it Piranesi, guys?
Well, I read that book too.
Yeah, so that's why I was thinking it may have not been that one, but I really like that one.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've read that one,
Dan. I recently, at a library sale, we have a library in town, Dan, you might like this, and they put volumes that they're no longer going to be in circulation, they put them in a little sale in this little side room. And the books are like a quarter for paperbacks and 50 cents for hardbacks. So I recently repurchased, I purchased for the first time The Road by Cormac McCarthy, which I'd read in one sitting 14 years ago. And I haven't read since because that book did me dirty.
Yeah.
That book grabs you and doesn't let you go. and Cormac isn't a Christian, but that book is profoundly human. Yeah. Like, in a way that few books are. So the book came to mind when I asked you the question. I thought, just a quick story maybe to close. I read that book while my wife was pregnant with our son, who's now 13. And my son saw me buy that book, and he said, "Hey, why'd you buy this?" And I said, "Well, because it's one of the best books I've ever read." And he said, "Can I read it?" And I said, not until you're 18. And then he said, what's it about? I said, well, it's about a dad trying to keep his 13-year-old son alive.
Yeah.
And I think it's a book about hope and evil and sacrificial love and human, the capacity for human destruction, but also the capacity for human love. Yeah. And it doesn't get saccharine or preachy, right? Mm-hmm. Right? There's no happy end. There's no Uncle Jesse sitting on the bed DJ at the end of Full House, you know, wrapping everything up in a nice bow. But anyway, I just thought, like, at some point, I actually would like to read that book with my son and have a deep conversation about what is love.
Yeah.
And what
absolutely
is hope.
That's the kind of book. I actually have a sort of fraught relationship with that book too. It's really, really poignant and so dark. I was telling somebody not too long ago, I listened to a lot of audiobooks, and I had listened to The Road on audiobook years back. Some years later, I was listening to, I think it was Plain Song by Kent Hariff, which is also a great novel. And something happened to me when the book came on. I was in the car and I had to pull over. I had this visceral reaction. And then I realized a little while later that night, what happened was it was the same voice talent who had read The Road that I had listened to a couple years earlier. And I associated that voice so heavily with that book that to hear it again in a different context when I wasn't expecting it was really overwhelming. But yeah, that's the kind of thing that, you know, I think it afflicts the comfortable and can comfort the afflicted in a way, because we're learning and we're growing and we're being pushed and challenged. Yeah.
Yes. Well, Dan, we could talk literature for hours. I'm sure you could too. I see your bookshelf
start
there
a whole
behind
new
you.
Podcast.
Yeah, we could. I really appreciate the time you spent with us. The work you do in this book, again, the title is called On the Spectrum, Autism, Faith, and the Gifts of Neurodiversity. I just think there are so many myths and so many misunderstandings about autistic people and autism. And as places, I mean, churches, we desire to be we desire to meet people where they're at. We say this all the time. We desire to be hospitable. We desire to be a place of welcome and of extending the love of Christ. And I think that the more we understand about the people we want to welcome, the more faithful we'll be in that intention. And your book helps, I think, connect us to a group of people that let's just say the church can improve in being a place of a hospital place for them. So thank you for your work. Thanks for the courage to share your story, Dan.
Yeah.
Thanks for
wrapping it up that way. I appreciate that so much. I think that if the book can help someone love their neighbor, whether it's their autistic neighbor or someone else who maybe is just a little different, I think that would be the greatest thing.
Yeah. Dan, if people are interested to learn more about you or maybe read other things you've written, where can they do that? Is there anywhere they can find you on the internet?
Sure. DanielBowmanJr.com. I just got a refresh not too long ago, so it's more sort of linked to this new book. I published a book of poems a few years back that no one ever read. so if they want to read that, that would be great. You know, and I have some other stuff happening too. I just wrote a piece for Sojourners that was out last week, and some other things. I love actually being online and talking to people. So if anyone wants to find me on Twitter or Instagram, it's also just at Daniel Bowman Jr.
Great. Well, Ben, can we track down that Sojourners article and put it in the show notes? Is that possible?
I shall try.
All right. Great.
I will make my best attempt.
Dan,
if you think
so
of it
much.
And know the link,
absolutely.
You can send it to us. Either way.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Dan. Have a great day.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebby, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online, as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. you'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.